WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is actor and satirist Harry Shearer. He starred in the mockumentaries This is Spinal Tap and A Mighty Wind, and with many of the same actors made the new movie comedy For Your Consideration, which opens this month. He also does many of the voices on The Simpsons, including Mr. Burns, Smithers, Principal Skinner, and Ned Flanders. On public radio, he hosts a program of music and satire called Le Show. And now he has a new satirical novel called Not Enough Indians. It's set in the fictional town of Gummidge, New York. Just as Gummidge is about to declare bankruptcy, the town council comes up with a scheme to save it. Gummidge will petition for Indian tribal status and try to open a casino. The only problem is, Gummidge doesn't have many Native Americans, so it takes some fancy lobbying to get Indian tribal status and transform the town into the Philoquonset Reservation. Harry, welcome back to Fresh Air. I want you to do a short reading from the book, and this kind of describes what happens in the casino once they open it.
Ladies and gentlemen, the management of the Philoquonset Casino welcomes you and reminds you that at no time during the show should flash photography be used, as it may panic the snow leopards. And now, first up, please welcome the Elvis of Bangkok, Shugat Thanakorn.
I thought this place used to have big-time entertainment. What the...
Tony Salata put a firm hand on the forearm of Vince Winstanley. The price of front-row comps is you don't knock the talent, he hissed through his new mustache. Then he flashed the $10,000 Salata grin at Eileen, and with a flourish, poured some more Dom in each of their glasses, while Shugat Thanakorn began a rousing rendition of what sounded like Fats Alaidmanman. By the way, Eileen, the Warhols really jazz up the fashion arcade. I never knew he painted Geronimo and those guys.
He didn't, Eileen Winstanley said while sipping her Dom. But Studio Warholia does. By the hundreds, all the Nat Am casinos are buying them. Not, she added proudly, at the price we got them for.
That's Harry Shearer reading from his new novel, Not Enough Indians. So did you go to Indian gambling casinos to see what they're actually like?
Yeah, I wanted to absorb some, as they say, local color. So I went to some casinos. There's a fabulous Indian casino in eastern San Diego County. And I went to some casinos along the Mississippi Gulf Coast before they got whacked by the hurricane. And I did a lot of reading on the subject of Indian. They like to call it gaming. Of course, we would understand it to be gambling.
What'd you see there?
Well, I saw the everything from the most utilitarian kind of get in here and gamble and get out to fairly lavish, if mismatched, arrays of tapestries and carvings and yes, Indian lore up the wazoo, as you might say.
So is it a landmine to write a book about Native American gambling without feeling like you're inadvertently insulting Native Americans? Do you know what I mean? Like, you have to walk a line here between figuring out what it is you're satirizing and what it is that you want to just respect.
Well, in many cases when I satirize something that may seem like it's walking the line, I'm really satirizing the way that it's being exploited or treated by the modern American media political universe. And I think that's true here. I'm satirizing the way white folks have discovered that it's now hip to be an Indian or a Native American and how to do that in a hurry, you know. And I guess I draw that from the way I had my bar mitzvah on the fly, you know. I had the quickie bar mitzvah. I didn't go to Hebrew school. I just studied the thing that you're supposed to read real fast and then had a bar mitzvah so I could get the gift. And it's sort of the same approach that these white folks are taking to how to be a Native American. That's the similarity.
Oh, that's a funny similarity. Except they don't have to learn the Haftorah to do it.
That's correct.
You don't gamble, so what do you do when you visit casinos?
I appreciate.
Not very risky, is it?
I'm an appreciator. No, I'm a fan of, I'm a student of how they have been students of human psychology. So, And a lot of that is reflected in the book. So, you know, the absence of right angles in the architectural planning of casino buildings always fascinates me, because they have learned, they have mastered the art of decontextualizing you. You know, the early version was no clocks, but they've gone way beyond that. As I say, now there are no right angles. And they've just learned the ways to make you feel so disoriented and so apart from your normal environmental cues that you will be loose, that your inhibitions will be loosened as a result, even before you start drinking.
Well, Harry, this is a busy time for you. In addition to your new novel, you've got a new movie coming out called For Your Consideration. That's the same crew that also did Best in Show, Waiting for Guffman, A Mighty Wind, and also some of the same people who are from Spinal Tap. But mm-hmm. but this is not a mockumentary. This is what?
Well, it's a mock you very much. It's Christopher Guest always bridles at the term mockumentary because he doesn't think he's mocking in terms of the tone of those films. But in terms of the camera technique, it is not a mock documentary in the sense that it's not a handheld camera that's moving around a lot. Chris wanted to make a movie that looked more like a formal narrative film, so the camera is more in place, except when it's on a dolly. But in terms of the acting, we're still improvising. So we're still, the actors are still doing the same thing that we've been doing in all these films, which is taking this story that's written by Chris and Gene Levy and improvising our dialogue. The only twist to that is this movie has a movie within the movie. And in the movie within the movie, we have scripted dialogue. So there's scripted dialogue and then there's improvised dialogue. And we would have days where, you know, the morning is scripted and the afternoon is improvised. And as an actor, you can't think of a better day than that.
So what's the story and what's the movie within the story?
The story is about a group of independent film actors of, let's say, second or, let's be realistic, third tier, who finally get a break and get to make this fairly okay film, called Home for Purim. That is the movie within the movie. A warm family drama that takes place during World War II. And and now we're outside the movie within the movie, and we realize that at some point during the filming of this, there's some internet buzz about Oscar possibilities for one or another of the actors in this film. And our story was really the story of Oscar buzz and how weird and silly and it is, and the effect it can have on people's lives and psyches.
And you play one of the third-tier actors.
Yes, I'm one of the stars of Home for Purim, Victor Allen Miller, an actor who, although he's worked for many years in the theater as well as film, is best known for his work as Irv the Footlong Wiener in the Felber hot dog commercials.
And did you pattern yourself on anybody in particular? Do you feel like you know a lot of actors who are like the actor that you're playing?
No, this is the first time as an actor that I've really patterned myself after me. I basically realized that if I just stripped away all of the parts of me that I like, I would have Victor. If I just took away what I'm maybe conceded to regard as my coping mechanisms, Victor would be the quivering pile of protoplasm that resulted. So this is the first time that I looked inward to create a character rather than outward.
And what about your ego versus Victor's ego?
Equally vulnerable, just equally fragile. It's why my friend Christopher Guest said to me at one point in sort of horror, "You don't read reviews, do you?" And I realized, yeah, that's kind of a stupid thing to do when you have a vulnerable ego. So I stopped, and I'm happier. They're usually good people, tell me, but I mean, it's never a good thing for people in this psychic environment to read reviews. But yeah, I mean, actors, you know, the only people who are more perpetually afraid of rejection than actors are salespeople. And unfortunately, they're the people who run America's major corporations, which tells you why our economy is in the shape it is today.
You know, by working with this repertory company all the time, you know, Christopher Guest and Michael McKean and, you know, the people who you've made a lot of
John Michael Higgins, Catherine O'Hara, Parker Posey, Jennifer Coolidge, Jane Lynch. Yes, go ahead.
You are all insulating yourself from the kind of rejection that you were just talking about because you're making your movies together. I mean, what you need is the money to make the movie, but you're not submitting yourself to a casting director or to a director who's never met who will completely misunderstand the true Harry Shearer and where your true genius lies.
Well,
do you know what I mean? It's like they're not, you don't have
to. Yeah, you're correct. It's a safe zone we're in when we work together, and certainly that's one reason why when we sit around when we know that Chris and Gene are working on another script waiting for the phone to ring so that we get to do it again. But I would possibly substitute another word for safety, and that's the word trust. Christopher trusts us as actors to be able to take a story that he and Gene have written and improvise the life of dialogue into it. He trusts the audience to get a comedy that's not shrill and exaggerated. And we trust Christopher not to put us in situations that we don't think are, you know, our areas of best expertise. So I think we feel safe, yes, but it's because something very rare in the business is happening, which is this atmosphere of trust. Normally, yes, and you've gone through these processes and you're working with somebody you may never have worked for before. My fear is a director will make me, the last take, he'll always say, can we have one that's bigger? And I know that that's the one he's going to use. And I'm in dread of that because I don't think I'm good big. I think I'm good at this kind of low-key, realistic level of comedy. And fortunately, that's the style that Christopher likes to work in as well.
You have another movie coming out, and this one's coming out next year. It's a new Simpsons movie. Can you tell us what the premise is?
I can't tell you anything about it. Except that it's coming out. There is such a penumbra of secrecy that surrounds this movie that it has a code name. I went to the studio one day and it didn't say The Simpsons, and I was there for a recording session for the movie, and I went to every studio we possibly use, and none of them said The Simpsons, and I called my office and said, what's the deal? And it turned out they had adopted a code name and just forgotten to tell me, which is good code. And I was recording, we're still recording the dialogue for the movie, and I was in a studio last week in New York, and at the end I said to the guy in the studio, now are you going to shred the script pages, because that's sort of the common practice. And he said no, and I was a little surprised. He said, I have to send them to L.A. for them to shred them there. They didn't even trust him to shred his own pages.
Well, and do you each have your names written on the script so they could tell whose script is absent and
oh, yes,
hold
but we're
you
not
responsible
allowed to
if your script doesn't show
there
up
would
for
be,
shredding?
Uh-huh. I think we would be shredded if there were a copy that made it out. But we're made to give them back every time, even though, yes, our names are imprinted. Our names are imprinted so frequently on a script page that it's sometimes hard to read the dialogue because our names are all over it.
So I understand that. So tell us the premise anyways. No, just kidding.
Yeah, right. No, but if you see the movie and you hear Mr. Burns just saying, Shearer, Shearer, Shearer over again, it's because all I could read was my name. The premise is that they want to make a lot of money.
My guest is Harry Shearer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor and satirist Harry Shearer. He's written a new satirical novel called Not Enough Indians. He stars in the new movie comedy For Your Consideration, which opens this month. And he does many of the voices on The Simpsons, which started its new season last night. Harry, as a satirist, you do a lot of political voices, including the president. You also always do the voices of TV news anchors. Mm-hmm. And you're in a new era now because on broadcast news, all the voices have changed. You know, it's no longer, you know, Ted Koppel and Tom Brokaw, Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, who I'm not sure you did.
I never did Peter Jennings, and Peter made fun of me for not doing he turned the tables and made fun of me for not doing him. I knew the melody of Peter Jennings, but I never quite had the thing. But I know Ted Koppel, if you will, has gone to Cable Vineyards to
plow new territory, if he might.
And Dan is in even weirder territory now with HDNet. And I'm sitting by my television trying to work on my Katie Couric impression. How sad is that? But there we are.
What are you getting from her?
Well, a certain corn-fed earnestness. I can't even begin to start doing it, my vocal impression of her yet. It's really still a work in progress, but there's a sort of roughness and sweetness to her voice, and a lot of nose in it too. It's like a wine. There's a big nose in that voice. But I must say I'm equally fascinated by the Katie Couric dance, the choreography of that broadcast. You know, she's, at least in the early weeks of it, she started off standing, the first segment, she's standing next to the desk, right thigh, just touching her desk. Then the next two segments, she's sitting at the desk in the traditional anchor pose, shuffling papers like a pro. And then the next two segments, she's standing nowhere near the desk in the Tom Brokaw, I'm an anchor, but I'm standing pose. And then, because you've waited 20 minutes to see her legs, the last two segments, she's sitting on the desk. It's so remarkable. If they just played music to that, they'd have a broadcast.
What about Brian Williams? Do you feel like you can get his voice?
I feel like I probably can if I ever get past my grudging admiration for him, which I'm working on.
Is that a problem? Does it get in your way?
Yeah. Yeah, of course it is. You know, The thing that makes me want to do people's characters is something about them drives me crazy. And I've always recognized a big distinction between people like me who are drawn to satirize those that they have a critique of, and other people that have been on shows that I've been on who seem to want to do characters because they want to be those people. They're doing characters they admire or had admired as kids, you know. Names supplied on request.
Like?
Oh, when you saw Billy Crystal doing Muhammad Ali, there was no critique of Muhammad Ali. Billy, you know, in another life would have loved to be Muhammad Ali. When you saw Joe Piscopo do Bruce Springsteen and Frank Sinatra,
right,
there was no critique. Joe wanted to be those guys. Would have loved to have been those guys. I don't particularly want to be anybody I've done. I'm doing them because there's something about what they do or the way they do it that bothers me, and humor is my way of making that critique.
Harry, you've been living for several years in New Orleans a good deal of the time, as your listeners know, because your show is often broadcast from there. How did you first decide to move there?
It was a weekend that I took off from doing a movie in Seattle and flew down to New Orleans for the Jazz Fest. And New Orleans was one of those places like Rio or like Brazil generally that I thought, well, yeah, I'd love to go there. I've heard such great things about it. And the minute I finally got there, my instantaneous response was, what has kept me from being here so long? It was an almost instantaneous falling in love with a place. And when I met my wife, the woman who was to become my wife, Judith Owen, and took her down there for the first time, I was just praying that she would love it as much as I do. And fortunately, she loves it, if anything, even more. And so we bought a place there. And it's a very deep place. It's 300 years old, and it hangs on to tradition and history in a way that no other American city really does. It doesn't have a little oldie towny section. It is an old town. And so when what happened last year happened, it was like seeing a loved one mugged, and you were angry and sad, and yet your love for had if anything strengthened and deepened. And it's going through a mental health crisis right now. It's going through a slow motion disaster that's comparable to the flooding disaster in the erosion and disappearance of the wetlands which protect us from hurricanes. And so there's a lot still to be done.
Did you feel like you've been changed as a person by living in New Orleans and seeing your adopted city through, you know, just really a horrible, tragic period? It's a really sobering thing for someone like you, who always kind of, you know, professionally dwells on the funny side of things.
Yeah, it's changed my public persona. You know, I've always been a fairly serious person with a funny front to me. You know, one of the reasons I love New Orleans is because the city never lost its sense of humor. This year's carnival was a spectacularly moving public ritual in which people who had been having these incredibly arduous days gutting their houses and fighting with insurance adjusters and all the other stuff came out in the streets to laugh at this two-week parade of editorial cartoons making vicious, wicked, bawdy fun of all the miscreants that had created their disaster. And to see that as a civic response, you know, that laughter could really be a civic response to a disaster, just, you know, that's my town. I'm so proud of it for having been able to do that. And for, you know, facing down everybody who said, oh, Mardi Gras, why should you be doing that when you've got serious business to do? It was really serious business to be able to laugh at the people who had put us in this mess.
Well, Harry Shearer, thanks a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Harry Shearer's new satirical novel is called Not Enough Indians. His new film, For Your Consideration, opens next month. He also has a new CD of his satirical sketches from his public radio program, Le Show, and a new DVD of his sketches from Saturday Night Live and his comedy specials. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.